It is Tuesday, December 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russia designates 9 U.S.-funded media outlets as foreign agents. Humanitarian and political concerns deepen in Yemen with the killing of the former president. And we look at the long road to recovery for opioid addicts. It's all ahead. Russia's Justice Ministry has designated 9 U.S. government-funded media outlets, including the Voice of America, as foreign agents, a move that could complicate their news-gathering operations in Russia. The ministry also listed Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and 7 of its affiliates after warning last month they could be affected. The new Russian designation forces the U.S. news outlets to adhere to the same requirements that are applied to foreign-funded non-governmental organizations under a 2012 law. The news outlets and any information they publish or broadcast to Russian audiences would be required to mention their designation as a foreign agent. Moscow's action Tuesday came in retaliation to Washington's move last month, forcing a U.S.-based affiliate of Kremlin-funded RT, formerly known as Russia Today, to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, also known as FARA. The act requires people acting as agents of foreign governments to publicly disclose their relationship. Nina Ognjanova is the Europe and Central Asia Program Coordinator to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Speaking from New York, she tells me about the new designation.
It is outrageous, really, that the Russian government, which has attacked, harassed, undermined, and stifled independent media, and which has failed to properly investigate murders of leading independent journalists in the country, it has moved on to curtail the work of international media organizations in the country. Those media organizations are vital for the entire media environment in Russia and for the ability of the public to receive alternative to the government-sanctioned news. We do believe that this was called actually a symmetrical approach by the Russian government, and we do believe that the U.S. actions on FARA against RT were ill-advised. We think that registering RT as a foreign agent was a very bad idea with potential ramifications, and now we are seeing these ramifications in action. However, the response that Russia has now unleashed is disproportionate, and this was used clearly as a pretext to justify the crackdown on alternative voices.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting, the 9 media outlets that were chosen, that Russia decided to do this against these particular ones. I don't know that has Russia taken any such action against, say, BBC or Deutsche Welle?
Well, we don't know how this newly amended law on foreign agents that the State Duma passed last month is going to be used and implemented. Those kinds of laws are prone to abuse and interpretation, and the practice shows that Russia has been using these kind of umbrella-type laws to arbitrarily punish specific critical and independent outlets. So we can't really say how many outlets will eventually be affected if more of them will be affected. The very fact that this law was amended in November to include media outlets that receive foreign funding is of utmost concern, and we are going to monitor and watch how this law is implemented with very closely and with great concern.
Because as you mentioned earlier, in Russia, basically, correct me if I'm wrong, but pretty much all of the, I guess, certainly electronic media, if not the printed media as well, is pretty much all controlled by the Russian government.
I mean, the media environment in Russia is very restrictive, especially over the past 5 years. Russian authorities have moved against even the little outlets of independent media end up with independent news. Some of the media had to either tone down their coverage or some of them had to go into exile in order to continue to provide independent coverage. The media environment is populated by and dominated by government-controlled media. Specifically, the television is, the national television is entirely state-controlled. And most people in Russia do get their news and content from those national television stations. There are still very few outlets of independent reporting, of investigative work that are available, but they're more and more under pressure and more under attack. So to now put any undue and extra restrictions on independent international media organizations is a further blow on the public's ability to get alternative and independent news and comment available to them.
Nina Ognjanova, Europe and Central Asia Program Coordinator to the New York-based Committee to Protect Journalists. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, John Conyers is a Democratic congressman from Michigan, or at least he was up until today, and he was the longest-serving member of the U.S. House of Representatives until today because earlier today, Congressman Conyers announced that he is resigning from the House of Representatives after facing weeks of sexual harassment allegations from members of his staff, including a settlement that he reportedly paid using taxpayer dollars. People are talking about this on social media. They have been for weeks and are talking about today, certainly with this resignation, saying it's the right thing to do after all of these instances, saying it's another instance of someone who's committed sexual harassment and assault being held accountable. But a lot of people talking, too, about Congressman Conyers' statement that he wants his son to take over and fill his seat. People saying this is not a dynasty. This is not something that is only for the Conyers family. So there's a lot of talk about that, the way that he went about making this resignation announcement on a call-in radio show, saying that he wasn't doing it in the proper way. So a lot of talk about this congressman being held accountable. Just another one of these cases of sexual harassment and assault that we've seen play out in the past few months, and this one playing out to the resignation of the congressman. The other big story trending, another story here related to the Washington area. President Donald Trump expected to announce either today or tomorrow that the United States will recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel rather than Tel Aviv, being met with outrage from around the world. Officials from Germany, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the European Union, just some of the countries, are saying that they're opposed to this move. But on the flip side, you have the mayor of Jerusalem, Nir Barkat, who has actually taken to social media with a video that he posted in the past day, urging President Trump to not be deterred by threats of terror and to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem as well. So there's a lot of debate about this, about what it means on the world stage. We'll have to see when that announcement comes out.
All right. Thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The full U.S. travel ban takes effect. A new survey says American attitudes are improving toward Arabs and Muslims. As we just heard, veteran Congressman John Conyers retires amid sexual assault claims. And in Brussels, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson offers the European Union strong U.S. support. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists theorize that soon after the Big Bang, the universe became a very dark place because of all the thick gas generated by this kick-starting process. The gas was said to be so abundant that any existing light had become trapped. The universe began to light up about a billion years later as it expanded, became more transparent, and filled with celestial objects like galaxies, planets, and stars. Scientists have been puzzled over just how the universe was able to pull itself out of these cosmic dark ages. But scientists at the University of Iowa have presented a new theory on how it happened. They found evidence that the huge black holes found in the center of galaxies began to throw out matter so viciously that the outpouring of material was able to push through the surrounding gas, finally allowing the light to escape. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, there's growing concern over President Trump's planned declaration of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The son of slain former Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh, killed by Houthi rebels Monday after switching allegiance to the Saudi coalition, called for revenge. Ahmed Ali Saleh told Saudi television Tuesday he will lead the battle until the last Houthi is thrown out of Yemen. Forces loyal to the longtime former leader had been allied with the Shiite Houthis in their three-year conflict against the Saudi coalition, backing current President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi. In the last week, Saleh forces battled the Houthis in and around the capital Sana'a, leaving hundreds dead or wounded. Saturday, Saleh said he was prepared to turn a new page in relations with Riyadh. Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Saleh tried to take advantage of a lull in the conflict to realign with the Saudi-led coalition against the Iran-supported Houthis.
What happened was that there was a sense of a lull after that last Saudi attack over there, and a number of people had been killed. And the presumption was, look, now is the time coming around where some sort of rapprochement could be reached, that some sort of peace could be achieved, some degree of nonviolence could be realized, which could then lead to something else. And the Saudis seem to have sent some messages along that line, indicating that if that weren't to happen, they would attack even more fiercely than they had done in the past. So it was under those circumstances that both sides were trying to, quote-unquote, establish their own foundations for the future. And that's where Saleh went wrong. Saleh went too far in supporting the Saudi-UAE group. And in the process, he was expecting and hoping that the Saudis and the UAE would be supporting him and sending in forces that will reinforce his forces in Sana'a to fight against Houthis. It didn't happen. Now you have a situation where the Saudi-UAE duo is really not as comfortable and as acceptable in that region, even for those people who are against the Houthis. And at the same time, Houthis have become more powerful.
The current president called for a new chapter in the battle against the Houthis after the Saleh death. He called upon the Yemeni people in all provinces still suffering under this criminal and terrorist militia to rise in its face and cast it out. Will they?
No. How do you expect these poor people who are dying like anything because of cholera and diphtheria and all other diseases, how do you expect them to stand up and fight? I think more important issue is going to be Saleh's children, especially his son, Ahmed Ali. He could very well bring together some of the people were very close, the tribals and others together, and could still fight on the same basis as his father would have done it. The problem is more complicated. The problem is that Ahmed Ali does not like the crown prince of Saudi Arabia.
There was hope that the break between Saleh's forces and the Houthis would make an opening to end this conflict.
Yeah.
Has that been dashed now?
Oh, yes. Because now the Houthis will never agree to anything that comes from the side of Saleh or his family or his friends.
That's Middle East Institute scholar Zubair Iqbal. Meanwhile, Yemen's humanitarian crisis deepens and many aid workers are trapped by the fighting. The UN has called the violence deeply disturbing and adds an extreme level of complexity to an already difficult political situation. Concern is growing in the Middle East over President Donald Trump's plan to change the U.S. position on Jerusalem. An announcement could take place in a speech on Wednesday, although the administration says no final decision has been made. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Arab and Muslim states are warning President Trump against a possible U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Regional leaders, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey, say such a declaration would destroy U.S. efforts to reach a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, what Trump has described as the ultimate deal. Senior Palestinian official Nabil Shaath says the president would no longer be a credible mediator.
He is out.
Shaath went on to say in Arabic that a U.S. nod on Jerusalem could lead to an eruption of violence. He said the Palestinian Authority does not condone violence, but may not be able to control the streets and prevent a third Palestinian uprising. Jerusalem is home to the Mosque of Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place in Islam. For Jews, it is the Temple Mount, the holiest site of all. Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barakat says American recognition of Israel's eternal capital is long overdue.
This historic step will send a very clear message to the world that the United States stands with the Jewish people and the State of Israel.
Jerusalem lies at the heart of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the international community maintains that its final status must be determined in negotiations. Nevertheless, President Trump says he is committed to a promise he made last year during the election campaign to move the U.S. embassy out of Tel Aviv.
We will move the American embassy to the eternal capital of the Jewish people, Jerusalem.
While Trump is not expected to move the embassy now, administration officials say recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital would show his resolve to do so eventually. That has put the region on edge. As one Palestinian official put it, President Trump is playing with fire. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. The opioid crisis in the U.S. has destroyed the lives of thousands of people, tearing apart families and communities. For addicts, the road to recovery is long and hard, and often fraught with many setbacks. It's estimated just 3% of substance abusers manage to stay clean for a lifetime. Jeff Swycourt profiles one opioid user who is battling for her sobriety at a residential rehabilitation center in Miami, Florida.
I have all the pictures of my family.
Like many opioid addicts, Allison Norland's substance abuse ran in the family, and she suffered trauma as a child.
My dad was actually an alcoholic. I started smoking when I was 18. As soon as the pills came into my life, everything else dropped out. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke pot, I didn't do cocaine, I did nothing else but the pills.
After having her first child while using, she sobered up. Then tragedy struck. Her father-in-law drove his car off a driveway, accidentally hitting and killing her daughter in front of her. The trauma sent Allison on a pill binge.
I didn't know how to be anymore. I didn't want to be anymore. To go from being a mom and loving this little thing so much more than I love myself, to having her gone and having this just absence in my heart, it was really hard.
After an arrest and time in another rehab center, Allison was eventually court-ordered here at The Village in Miami, a residential and outpatient treatment center. Like 70% of substance abusers, Allison has a history of physical, mental, and sexual abuse.
Services need to be trauma-informed.
Frank Robito is Senior Vice President for WestCare, which runs the village.
Oftentimes, your trauma is a trigger for the use of drugs. So if we can deal with trauma, we can also impact some of the causative factors associated with drug use.
My therapist has been incredible and has helped me through, again, things I did in the dark that I never thought would come to light, or things that happened to me that I never wanted to talk about. I've talked about with her, and it's because I know she can understand, and I know she can relate to what I'm saying and what I've done.
Okay, let's begin with the checkout over here.
Allison's court appointment was initially for 90 days. At first, she was hostile toward being here.
My new commitment is...
4 months later, she has made a turnaround.
To look back at myself and to see how far I've come and to see the growth and the change, and to have other people tell me they can see the change in me, to have my family welcome me back with open arms because I am working so hard and I am able to share this with them. It's been amazing.
The next time you feel like doing something that is unsafe.
She says the safety she has found here has allowed her to confront some painful realities.
I put my daughter in harm's way for a pill. I put my life in danger for a pill. I was risking everything for this drug. And that's it. Chasing a high that was never, ever going to be enough. It's never enough.
Right in here.
Allison now wants to become an addiction specialist.
That's the huge thing for me. That's what I want to do. I want to help people. I want to help people like me.
Jeff Swicord, VOA News, Miami.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gone are the days when the Taliban, citing religious objections to opiates, banned the growing of poppies. Now, up to 85% of the world's opium production occurs in areas under Taliban influence, leading to the Taliban and other non-state armed groups annually lining their pockets and financing nefarious activities with hundreds of millions of dollars from the illegal drug trade. But the United States and its Afghan partners have the Taliban's narcotics networks squarely in their sights. In November, the Allies began targeted strikes on Taliban drug labs, including airstrikes by U.S. forces that are part of the expanded legal authorities given to the U.S. military under President Donald Trump's new strategy for Afghanistan, announced in August. At a recent press briefing, General John Nicholson, commander of Resolute Support and U.S. Forces Afghanistan, said the new authorities are a demonstration of the will of the United States to take the fight to the enemy in all its dimensions.
And specifically, in striking Northern Helmand and the drug enterprises there, we're hitting the Taliban where it hurts, which is their finances.
General Nicholson said the strikes occur only after numerous hours of surveillance, not only to pinpoint the specific objective, but to minimize collateral damage. He also made clear that the U.S. and Afghan forces are not targeting the farmers who grow the poppies. The farmers are often compelled to do so by the Taliban as a payment of debt or form of coerced servitude. Instead, the targets are the labs where poppies are processed into opium, morphine, and eventually into heroin. General Nicholson said the level of trust between the United States and Afghanistan has never been higher.
And it's because of this that we're able to conduct these kind of joint operations. And we're able to do these operations with the full support and indeed leadership of the Afghan government.
General Nicholson said the U.S. and Afghanistan will continue to apply military pressure on the enemy, and that the international community's increased diplomatic and economic pressure is having an effect on the external enablers of the insurgency. Credible elections in Afghanistan will add crucial needed social pressure. These are the things that will mean that the Taliban cannot win, said General Nicholson. Our message to them is, it's time to lay down your arms and enter into a reconciliation process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.